go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Give you my solemn word, I will not sing I Left My Heart in San Francisco. This is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com, broadcasting live from AIC headquarters, the Appalachian Community Health Emergency Campaign on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. I've been gone. Golly Moses, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, flew back Monday, got home, got back to D.C. about 9:30 last night. I'm still shaking off a little bit of it. Nah, I wouldn't call it jet lag. It's just when the turnaround is that quick, I mean, I feel bad for, like, traveling sports teams and stuff because, you know, wow, messes with you for about a day or so. But all in all, it was the memorial service I attended was a truly beautiful affair. Well done, with a lot of beautiful words for an awfully, awfully good person. And in and amongst all of that, in answer to a question from Marty, he says, I'm trying to increase gain here. Marty says, except for the reason you were here, did you enjoy your time in San Francisco? Yes, absolutely. It was amazing. Nothing short of utterly amazing. I'd never seen San Francisco before. By the way, The Horn is available in a wide variety of platforms and formats, not just headonradionetwork.com, but via a number of streaming platforms for smartphones and whatnot. Things like, TuneIn Radio, Stitcher Radio app, the Tuner Internet Radio app that I found in the iTunes store. There's a bunch of them. You can also get the podcasting feed at whiterosesociety.org under our subdomain, Head On with Bob Kincaid, and you can always pick up the podcast at iTunes.com. Now, where to go? Still tweaking the audio a little bit along the way, so please bear with me. I've got it jacked up about as far as it'll go right now. Scheduling stuff. Regular shows tonight and tomorrow night. And then Thursday and Friday, we will be at the Health Action, presented by Families USA. And that's Thursday and Friday from down at the Hyatt Hotel on New Jersey Avenue in Washington, D.C. Once again, I'm getting to enjoy my periodic role as wheelman for Mike Malloy, picking Mike up at the airport tomorrow. And bringing him in. And then we'll do the broadcast. I'll actually be broadcasting live from 9 to noon, and Rick Smith will probably be going live. Rick will be going live 9 to noon. I'll be going noon to 3. And then it will be a repeat during the evening of all the guests and
the folks that we have talked to. So that's the schedule. Not sure yet when we're going home. It looks like there's a possibility we may be here through Wednesday and maybe going home Thursday or something like that. Watch this space, as the saying goes. The Horn is, of course, a listener-supported experience. Big thanks going out this evening to Janie, who got us started, of course, yesterday being a non-broadcast day. And there's been a few of those. January is a bit of a struggle. But Janie got us started, and I would encourage she took care of one night's broadcasting. And I would encourage anyone who would like to thank her for what she has done to match it. You know, 2 at 75, 3 at 50, 6 at 25, 10 at 15, 15 at 10. You know the drill. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. So, too, is the snail mail address. And thank you very kindly, Jana Jerry, from last night as well. It was as well as Paul. Thank you, Paul. It all is ever so very much helpful. Now, this is, and that's the thing, I'm kind of lost. Just to give you, it would be unfair not to give you a little bit of a travel log update. There were so many high points, it's almost hard to catalog them all, even though it was only a matter of Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then morning Monday. As we all know, I had never seen California. And I think I have a better understanding now of why it is so magic to so many people. Apart from the late January we experienced a couple of years ago down in the Caribbean, I'd never been in such a nice place in such an ordinarily bitterly cold month. It was beautiful. I loved it. People said, well, it might be a little cool out here. You might want to bring a coat. Oh, what passes for cool in San Francisco? Oh, that was funny. What an awesomely functional, funky piece of the universe that is. Big thanks go out to our buddy Tom, who has been a longtime supporter of this program and, in fact, provided a challenge last week to help keep things going, offered to triple folks' money up to, about $150. Tom's been listening for a very long time. Hey, Tom. And Tom got in touch with me while I was there, and he knows that I have a long-standing dream of or fascination with the sea and sailboats and stuff. And Tom graciously invited me to go sailing on San Francisco Bay. And we did that Sunday. We left the place where Tom keeps his boat, about a 33-footer, and it's beautiful. And we got out into the bay and sailed over toward Mount Tam. You know, I'm a local now. We can just call it Mount Tam. I don't have to stumble through Tamalpais. Ha! I said it right, I think. And came rolling back, sailing back. Saw some seals hanging out on the channel marker buoys. Saw some sea lions playing in the water. It looked like the wet heads of little Labrador retrievers bobbing there in the water of the bay. Beautiful. And the whole area is just breathtakingly beautiful. And I got to honest to goodness, check one of my dreams off the list. And bless his heart, Tom even trusted me with the tiller for a few minutes, and that was a lot of fun. Didn't have a lot of wind, but I didn't need a lot of wind. I just needed to be there. It was magic. It really, really was. The previous day, and I think I tweeted one of these photographs, the previous day I had gotten to go across the Golden Gate into Muir Woods, and I got to see the ancient redwood trees. And truly, because you know how I am with religion, right? Yeah. I haven't felt like I was in a sacred space or a holy place in a very, very long time. But in that moment, walking into Muir Woods, to be among trees that are in excess of 1,000 years old, gracious, that feels like sacred space. More so than any pile of stones or bricks or anything else that will eventually, with time, be reduced to rubble and made by the hand of man. So we did that on Saturday, Muir Woods. And then on Sunday I was on the bay. That was 2 churches in 2 days. The flight out was incredibly long, even for a flight across the continent. I have discovered, a fan of United Airlines. I had a window seat on the way out, and it was a brutal one. I think it took about another hour or so off the plane for me to actually unfold my shoulders. The high point of the journey out, though, came when, toward the end of the flight, a marching band from a high school in Hawaii that had marched in the inaugural parade back in D.C. was on its way home. And the flight attendant thanked them for flying United. But apparently she had not spent a lot of time ever applying the art of word knowing to Polynesian words, because she had trouble with all the, maybe she was a newbie, I don't know, but she had trouble with all the in-flight instructions. And then when we got to the end, she said, and we at United would like to thank the students of and the marching band of King Kamehameha High School in Honolulu, Hawaii, and just ran right through. Yeah, King Kamehameha High School. Sounds like a jovial Marxist. Kamehameha. I was sitting next to one of the students, and I said, "Sorry about the Kamehameha." He said, "It's okay, bro." It was funny. Kamehameha. It was, like I said, all in all, it was just a magnificent trip. Coming back here, just this evening, right before showtime, we peeled in. Tom brought me a few oranges from his tree. You can't get much more fresh than that. And just peeled one and got after it a very little bit ago. It was, in a word, delightful. But so many things are out there. When we drove across on Saturday to go to Muir Woods, well, just crossing the Golden Gate Bridge is plenty. It was plenty exciting for me. Do you remember a long time back when we were talking about something in terms of climate and weather, and Sandra said, but I'm not going to complain, I'm in California. Well, I didn't really have a point of reference for that. Now I do. Now I really do. We crossed the Golden Gate Bridge and went up into Marin County. Whenever we were on our way to Muir Woods, the road that bends and winds and turns its way down to Muir Woods looks like one of those roads that they close off for commercials that they make to advertise sports cars. I think there was about 3 inches of actually straight road. Yeah, went all the way up to Mount Tamalpais and came all the way down into Muir Woods, stopped at the top of the hill, and bought fresh produce from a guy on a truck by the side of the road. Got dried figs and blood oranges and a couple of lemons and just wonderful. Fresh nut, pistachios, what have you. Oh, it was good. It was delightful. And the view. I will be a very long time forgetting that view. I shot a bunch of pictures with my phone. You'll recall that the little Belgian bastard stole my good camera back last May. Hope he chokes on it. But I shot a number of photos with my phone, and I'll try to get some of those up on Twitter and hopefully on Facebook. Well, they'll transfer over to Facebook. So if you're following me on Twitter or on Facebook, you can see them that way. Thanks, Marty. Marty got another note. Never sailed on the bay. Oh, I can't begin to describe it. Just, well, it's a transcendental experience. It truly is. Marty noting, I just call United Continental. That way I don't feel indignant over United's treatment of their retirees. By the way, we really must get you and your family further north to the Sequoia National Forest. On a good day, you'll have trouble leaving. Yeah, I get that. Oh, I found and I met fantastic people. Wonderful people. Committed people who, because, you know, we talked a lot about the AIC Act and the AIC campaign. And it was easier to explain it out there than it is a mile from my home in West Virginia. No joke. We'd start explaining to people in the Bay Area, and they, well, yeah, of course, absolutely. Whereas you try to talk about it back in West Virginia, and you get, well, what about the jobs? Tree hugger. By the way, up on my Facebook page and in my Twitter feed, there is a tree-hugging photograph. Right, you couldn't get off the boardwalk or the trail. They didn't want you to leave the trail or anything, so I didn't. I'm a rule-abiding person. But there was one little itsy-bitsy baby redwood, maybe just 150 years old or so, right by the fence line of the boardwalk, and I leaned over and gave it a big old hug. And a photograph was snapped of it. Those people who complain about tree huggers are people who have never hugged a tree. It feels really good. It feels cleansing. It feels grounding. Oh, Sergi, it's too much to go into, but Sergi says, since I'm still very new to this community, I'm kind of curious about the story attached to your line about the little Belgian bastard. You got your camera stolen in Belgium? No, I got my entire backpack stolen in Belgium, Sergi. with a laptop, an audio interface, and yes, my good point-and-shoot digital camera, among a great deal of other things. Little bastard skipped away. So whenever you... All right, no giggling. Yeah, now we've got them all going. Agnes is giggling from the bedroom. Margie's giggling in here. You giggling, Ferg?
Do you want us to skip, darling?
No, no skipping. Thank you. No,
I'll
But Margie's going to skip and rub it in, even though she's doing it on one bad ankle. My family, it's so good to be loved. Yeah, that's the skip, Ferg. That's the skip. Yep, just like something out of a Monty Python skit. Absolutely. Little Belgian bastard. But I hope, more than anything else, I was by myself. I didn't have Agnes or Margie or Doodle or Ferg with me. And more than anything else, I kept tweeting stuff and texting stuff back to them. I really do want them to see it. You can get very inured to the sort of minor key lifestyle of the flannel-shirted Stalinist Republic of West by God, Virginia. And then you see things working like they're supposed to work. And it blows your mind. You can actually become used to dysfunction so that functionality is actually shocking. Culture shocking, if you will. Ron and Raleigh noting a suggestion, Bob. May I suggest on those cross-country flights, request a bulkhead or emergency row seat. I'm 6'3" tall, and when I used to fly to Las Vegas each year, I could see the seat spacing shrink over a 20-year period. Yes, United sucks. I've always called it a cattle car with wings. Oh, well, and on the way home, I've never had this seat in the plane before. I had probably the worst seat in the plane. It was a 737 out and a 737 back. I looked under my seat cushion because I was checking out the flotation device. And I saw where someone had written in, like, ancient Sharpie, Wilbur and Orville were here. But I was literally in the aisle seat, the last aisle seat, back by the rear bulkhead. It would not recline. Next to the lavatory. I got to see every human being on that plane as they headed for the John. And every time they pressed that little vacuum flush button, I was pretty well convinced that we were about to go down in flames because it's this huge explosive roar. I mean, you expect it when you're in there. But when it goes on behind you, you jump. Jesus Christ, what's going on? Is it time to... Are the little things going to drop? Little things going to drop from the ceiling now? But yeah, at 6'2", Ron, I'm right there with you. I felt like I'd been kneecapped by the time we landed. Jenny writing in, she says, "Oh, my favorite place. I can smell the eucalyptus trees. I love Muir Woods. It's a special kind of pretty." Now, hopefully there'll be time for more travel, more seeing of it. Jack writes in from Shreveport, "Sailing's so cool, something I'd really like to be able to do at least a few times a year. Sounds like a great time." If you want to see Muir Woods, you can go to nps.gov, M-U-W-O, nps.gov/MUWO/index, and just do a Google search for Muir Woods, M-U-I-R, and look at the images, and yeah, you'll see those magnificent trees. Just gorgeous. Rode a cable car. Oh, this was fun. On Saturday, Maria Gano, who was out there with me, and I rode a cable car down California Avenue to right there where the ferry station is. What is that, the Embarcadero? And there was all kinds of music going on. And it was one of those little object lessons in why I prefer our side to the right-wingers and the weirdos and the various and sundry assorted booger eaters. There was a pro-choice rally going on. First of all, yay. Second of all, it was one of the funnest looking, most enjoyable looking rallies I've ever seen. They were dancing. Thousands of people, and there were bubble machines blowing soap bubbles into the air. And the energy was palpable. There were bright orange signs that said, abortion, on demand and without apology. Yes, yes. There was a neck and neck contest for my favorite sign that I saw, though. One of them said, life begins when you oppose Christian fascism. And the other one said, keep your rosaries off my ovaries. Yeah, it's kind of a tie for first place, isn't it? Huge banner that said, fetuses are not babies, women are not incubators. Hallelujah. But we walked around down there a little bit and just sort of reveled in the normalness of it. See, I figured something out. A lot of the country, and especially redneck country, southern country, there are two places on earth, at least inside the United States, that southern rednecks profess to despise. One of them is New York City. The other place, is San Francisco. And your average conservative right-wing Southerner hates both places because both places are an absolute unapologetic, unqualified rejection of all the tired, worn-out, phony aristocratic bullshit with which the South wraps itself. If you've ever read Pat Conroy's The Prince of Tides, he goes into a long digression about why he hates New York and how he's the narrator, you know, he says, I am a professional hater of New York, and then quietly goes about the business of admitting how much he loves the place. Places like New York and San Francisco scare right-wingers, teabaggers, repiglickens, pro-lifers, booger-eaters, deathers, tenthers, the usual suspects. They fear them because, in the main, these cultures in these places are making a truly American success of diversity. It happens in a lot of major cities. You'll recall, for instance, Pastor John Hagee blaming gay folks for the horrors of Katrina. If, God forbid, the ground moves underfoot on the California coast, I'm sure John Hagee and other right-wing Jesus goons will be there to blame that on gay folks, too. You'll recall that Mahmoud, I'm a hand job or I'm a dinner jacket or, yeah, over there, he's blamed gay people for volcanoes and earthquakes. Look, they're not so different after all. Christian fundamentalists, Muslim fundamentalists. It's not the religion, it's the fundamentalist part that makes them so much fun. But your right-wingers, your conservatives, your teabaggers, your libertarians, etc., they do. They despise these places and do everything they can to make other people think that there's something wrong with them, when if you take just about any given average little redneck person like me, and finally, long after first yearning to see the place, let him see it, well, it's a classic case of how you're going to keep them down on the farm when they've seen something like this. Because it's magic, and it works. Because it's true. I first read On the Road and Dharma Bums, both by Jack Kerouac, when I was about 15, 16 years old, and began dreaming of that far western shore. I was 15 or 16 years old when I read a poem by one of my very favorite poets, a man named Gary Snyder, who is rendered as Jaffe Ryder in Kerouac's The Dharma Bums. Jenny wrote a few minutes ago to say that she loved the smell of the eucalyptus. Well, Gary Snyder once wrote a poem called Marin On, Marin-An. Sun breaks over the eucalyptus grove below the wet pasture. Water's about hot. I sit in the open window and roll a smoke. Distant dogs bark, a pair of cawing crows, the twang of a pygmy nuthatch high in a pine. From behind the cypress windrow, the mare moves up, grazing. A soft, continuous roar comes out of the far valley of the six-lane highway. Thousands and thousands of cars driving men to work. I read that 35 years ago or so, along with a lot of other of Snyder's poems, many of which have to do with that area. In places like San Francisco, to a little 16-year-old redneck boy, places like Marin County, places like Berkeley, stores like City Lights Books, obtained a sort of far-off end-of-quest quality. To a certain extent, while I was there as well, I was conscious that it was exactly 70 years ago that an 18-year-old boy, hillbilly boy, my father, was walking those streets as well, getting ready to ship out to the war in the Pacific. And so I tried to be mindful of that as well. Walked into a really, really, really old oyster bar and had a plate of Pacific Ocean oysters. My father had said he never cared for the Pacific Ocean oysters. He preferred the Atlantic Ocean for his oysters. And I don't often gainsay the wisdom of my father, but he was wrong on this one. Those were some delightful oysters. Had some from Drake's Bay and had some from further up the coast in Washington. They weren't sweet like an Atlantic oyster, like a Blue Point or a Kokini. They had a bright brilliance to them. But, oh, heavenly days, they were good. And the line coming out of Swan Oyster Depot on Polk Street in San Francisco, it was half a block long, but I wasn't walking away. And I was well rewarded. More stuff will probably come to mind about all of this during the course of the evening, and I'll try to bring it up when it does. But mostly I've just been sort of sitting quietly and reflecting on it all. San Francisco is a town of so many people that have done so many things that matter so much to me. A youngish Sam Clemens talking about how the coldest winter he ever survived was summer in San Francisco. Or Dashiell Hammett having been a Pinkerton thug, developing a very leftward-leaning philosophy, even as he sat writing things like The Thin Man and The Maltese Falcon. Asking around for evidence or remaining structures that pre-existed the 1906 earthquake and fire. Wondering, because how sad that must have been for Mr. Clemens, Mark Twain. I'm sure he had to know about the fire and the earthquake, because he did love San Francisco. And within a year or so of what would be his death, to be told that it was all gone. Well, the places where the beats hung out. Yeah, there's plenty of reasons to go back. Plenty of wonders yet to track down. I hope we get to do Netroots Nation down in San Jose. It would be wonderful. Heavens to Betsy, the cab ride. I immediately thought of Tracy. I got a cab out of SFO headed into town to my hotel. I don't think my cab driver was as much fun as Tracy is. My cab driver didn't have a lot to say. He just stuck the cab over in the left lane of 101 and ran it up past 85 and tried never let it fall below it. Found myself wondering if I was going to actually live to see San Francisco. Yeah, the suggestions are rolling in. Jim says try the Russian River area and wind through the wine country. Beautiful. I'd love to see it, Jim. Tim from L.A. saying, speaking about Redwood, your next trip is to Kings Canyon National Park in California and visit General Sherman, the Redwood tree. Yeah, that's a big tree. This gigantic tree has been through fires, floods, natural climate change, and yes, man-made climate change, but still manages to survive and grow. When we're long gone as a species, General Sherman will keep on going. Height above base, 274.9 feet. Circumference at ground, 102.6 feet. Maximum diameter at base, 36.5 feet. Yeah. Amazing? Yes, Tim, it is amazing. I want to see some more. It was really weird walking into Muir Woods. People would be chatting out in the parking lot, and immediately after crossing under the arch, this is Muir Woods National Monument, they hushed. They hushed like they had walked into church. And for my part, I felt pretty sure that I had. It was magic. Dr. John writing in a little bit ago, when I mentioned picking Malloy up tomorrow, he said, Bob is Malloy's wheel man. That should give shivers right down. That should send shivers down right-wing spines worldwide. Would I love to be a fly on the windshield in that car? Yeah, in the car, not outside, because the ones on the outside go splat. Oh, it's always fun. It's always fun to see Mike. But enough travel log. It's about 19 minutes before the hour. And it's time to jump into the meat and potatoes of Titanic Tuesday. Titanic Tuesday, so named, of course, for that Titanic intellect and all the Titanic right-wing intellects. But in this case, Titanic Tuesday is, the Titanic right-wing intellect and Beckley, who told his knuckle-breathing, mouth-walking followers, yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it, that there are fossils in rock strata of West Virginia because of the movement of the Titanic plates. The Titanic plates. Now, let's get Titanic Tuesday kicked off with this note from Ron and Raleigh. Remember, Bob, what St. Ronnie of Raygun said about the redwoods?
Yeah, if you've seen one tree, you've seen them all.
Yeah, that whole concept of genetic diversity was just kind of lost on St. Ronnie of Raygun. But then again, by that time in his life, most everything was lost on St. Ronnie of Raygun. But even back when he was saying that if you've seen one tree, you've seen them all. Well, he just had a dead soul, didn't he? I know we feel a little funny talking about things like souls. But there was just something in him that didn't work right. That made him incapable of really fully grasping the human experience. Texas Betsy pointing out, we are studying landforms in science, fifth grade, and one of my students said Titanic plates, but he's 10, and not my best reader. Betsy, I would put him up against this Titanic wit from Beckley in a heartbeat, and it wouldn't be a fair fight. Be another case of bringing a rubber chicken to a sword fight. Well, thank you, Margie. Margie's been liking that rubber chicken to a sword fight line. It's weird working here in the AIC headquarters because I usually don't work with a live studio audience. But with Margie is a great audience member because she's a good laugher. As far as kicking off Titanic Tuesday is concerned as well, how about this? A note from Dr. John. He starts by pointing out a story from The Hill. Headline, Hispanic group to GOP congressman. Watch your language. A leading GOP Hispanic group has a message for Republicans as Congress begins debate on immigration. Watch your language. The Hispanic Leadership Network, a center-right group, oh dear, looking to woo Latinos to the GOP, sent Republican congressmen of all stripes a list of suggested do's and don'ts of immigration reform Monday afternoon. The memo was obtained by The Hill. Quote, from the memo, tone and rhetoric will be key in the days and weeks ahead as both liberals and conservatives lay out their perspectives. Please consider these tonally sensitive messaging points as you discuss immigration, regardless of your position. Hispanic Leadership Network Executive Director Director Jennifer Korn sent that out. Republicans are now being encouraged, and this is going to drive people like Tom Tancredo crazy. More on Tom Tancredo later. Republicans are no longer supposed to refer to Hispanics not born in this country who are here under, you know, the sort of predatory forced migration that NAFTA, yeah, you understand. Republicans are not supposed to call them illegal aliens anymore. Or illegals. Or even aliens. They're anchor babies, that phrase is right out. It's a pretty, I don't know if there's a Republican out there who can follow these suggestions. Do acknowledge that President Obama broke his promises and failed to propose any immigration reform for 5 years while using this issue as a political wedge. Don't focus on amnesty as a tenet of immigration reform. It goes on. But Dr. John says, among the words they're told not to use, anchor baby, illegals, amnesty. Also, they apparently need to be told that, quote, not all Hispanics are undocumented and not all undocumented immigrants are Hispanics. So the GOP has now been told by its own members that they can't talk about, quote, why rape is okay. They can't be overtly racist to a large and growing demographic. And they can't vote us into economic ruin. Says Dr. John, geez, no more misogyny, racism, or flawed economics? Honestly, what else does the GOP stand for? Quick answer, Dr. John, not much. At the same time that I was seeing these wonderful folks, it was a day later, the wonderful pro-choice folks dancing in bliss in San Francisco the day previous, the pro-life goobers were losing their minds here in Washington, D.C. Not but a few feet away from here. They were engaging, and you know what, you know that I'm using this as a term of art. This is not a term of opinion. But they were engaging in some of the nastiest slut-shaming. And I explained what slut-shaming meant to Ferg, and when he saw it, he knew it for what it was. They had a bunch of women, especially, there were teenage girls, Ferg?
Yeah,
there were teenage girls who were marching around carrying signs saying, I regret my abortion. Black signs with white letters. And they were being brought up to the podium to talk about how ashamed they were of exercising control over their own bodies instead of letting some tired old religion or male or authority figure do it for them. I mean, that is slut-shaming in the extreme. Ferg videoed some of it. Made a really excellent little video, but I don't know how we can get it out there. But Agnes from the next room says, we will. But eventually, they whipped themselves into such a frenzy that they got their rally for life there in front of the Supreme Court shut down. because one or some of them apparently started making terroristic threats about what needed to happen if we don't stop the fetus Holocaust. And that's another thing. There was lots of talk about the abortion Holocaust. Now, I would not dare speak for someone who had family in the real Holocaust, but I can suppose, I can try to empathize my way into that circumstance, and I can think that I would be right damn furious to have someone comparing a woman making a decision about the functioning of her body to the deliberate murder of several millions of real human beings. Equating a woman making a decision about the workings of her body with Hitler. Yeah, what did Lewis Black call that several years ago? Yeah, they've got Hitler Tourette's. And they got their little rally shut down because eventually, we'll blow this place up. God knows what they said. But Ferg and Agnes wandered over there and came back and said, they're scary. They're weird, and we don't want to be around them anymore. I mean, you look at the two, and the choice is easy as far as I'm concerned. It's pretty simple. It's who would you rather hang out with? And the answer comes pretty quick. I want to hang out with the people who sing and dance, not the people who threaten to blow things up. Now, I want to go back for a minute to something else, though. Dr. John pointed out that the GOP now has been told by its own members that they can't, not all Hispanics are undocumented and not all undocumented immigrants are Hispanic. You would think the concept would be pretty easy. But it's not. And it reminds me, of a lesson in logic from the geniuses over at Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Good evening. The last scene was interesting from the point of view of a professional logician because it contained a number of logical fallacies, that is, invalid propositional constructions and syllogistic forms of the type so often committed by my wife. All wood burns, states Sir Bedivere, therefore he concludes, all that burns is wood. This is, of course, pure bullshit. Universal affirmatives can only be partially converted. All of Elmer Cogan is dead, but only some of the class of dead people are Elmer Cogan. Obvious, one would think. However, my wife does not understand this necessary limitation of conversion of a proposition. Consequently, she does not understand me. For how can a woman expect to appreciate a professor of logic if the simplest cloth-eared syllogism causes her to flounder? For example, given the premise all fish live underwater and all mackerel are fish, my wife will conclude not that all mackerel live underwater, but that if she buys kippers it will not rain, or that trout live in trees, or even that I do not love her any more. This she calls using her intuition. I call it crap, and it gets me very irritated because it is not logical.
You get the idea. That's where the Republicans live. You know, in the same place where trout live in trees. Not all Hispanics are undocumented, and not all undocumented immigrants are Hispanics. And the Republicans conclude that if they buy kippers, it will not rain, or that trout live in trees. Yes, indeed. So there we start with the Jim going back to the geniuses in Beckley. Glad you did not hear the misinformation and opinions of the metric system by said luminaries of the right wing. Same, same. So there we have it with tonight's, or at least the beginning of tonight's filibuster. I am tickled to know that we have a Green News report tonight from our dear friends Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. We'll take a little break. We've got a track sent in by the Decemberists from our buddy Michael. He says, one of my all-time favorite songs by one of my all-time favorite bands set on New Year's Day in San Francisco. Excellent. So we'll take a little break. We'll run the Green News Report. And then we will come back to your calls. Now, we are still here working on the AIC campaign, the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign, on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., so we do not have the regular phone lines available, but by Jove, Skype is. And the Skype handle here is Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N. If you're already on the contact list and you want to get involved in the conversation, jump right in. Or if you want to make contact, send a request. I'll clear it. I'll okay it. And you'll be into the conversation lickety-split. Either way works fine. We are listener-supported, looking to find a few friends tonight to follow in the footsteps of our good friend Janie, who took care of tonight's fundraising. We'll get to catch up a little bit if some folks will step in alongside her and help her carry the weight. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. So, too, is the snail mail address. So, let's take a little musical interlude, followed by the Green News Report, and then jump in on Skype as you wish. This is Conversation Radio of a decidedly liberal, progressive bent. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Cathedral Health, all wrapped in bones of setting sun, all dust and stone and moribund. I paid 25 cents to light a little white candle for a New Year's Day. I sat and watched it burn away, then turned and weaved through slow decay. We were both a little hungry, so we went to get a hot dog. Down the high street here, the light was slight and disappeared. The air, it stunk of fish and beer. We heard a Superman trumpet play the national anthem. And the world may be long for you, but it'll never be long to you. Put on a motorbike when all the city lights blind. Your eyes tonight, are you La la la.
It's Tuesday, January 29, 2013.
Shame on you. Shame on Congress.
Superstorm Sandy disaster aid finally passed by Congress.
Green jobs, cleaner, greener communities, cleaner, greener transportation.
U.S. Transportation Secretary stepping down. Catastrophic floods in Australia while drought spreads across the U.S. Polls show climate action a winner with voters. Plus,
I can't imagine the leaders of Scotland could be so stupid as to allow this to be built.
Who in New York is paying to protest wind farms in Scotland?
Who indeed? Answers to all of those questions and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comments.
I know America beat Tojo, we crushed Hitler, we put a man on the moon, but incrementally reducing CO2 emissions? That sounds like a lot of work.
Tell me about it, Stephen. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, a bit of personal news here today. We are now beginning our 10th year at the Brad Blog. We just passed our 9th anniversary days ago.
Wow, double digits. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. And to you. What do you have for us today to kick off our 10th year in the Green News Report division?
Well, first, some quick headlines. A new poll from the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication finds that talking about climate action on climate change is a clear political winner with voters. The poll found 58% of registered voters will consider candidates' positions on global warming when they decide how to vote, and they support ending subsidies for the fossil fuel industry and regulating carbon dioxide as a pollutant.
So the voters like it, but the funders for the candidates, maybe not so much.
Yeah, not so much. The Australian military rescued over 1,000 people from their rooftops.
Why is there 1,000 people on the Australian military's rooftop?
Okay, yeah, maybe I could have written that better. The Australian military rescued over 1,000 people from rooftops.
That's better.
Thank you. After torrential rains from Tropical Cyclone Oswald caused deadly flooding in the country's northeast this week and damaged water treatment plants across two states. This is just 2 weeks after record heat waves and wildfires ripped across central Australia. In Southeast Africa, the UN agency UNICEF is pleading for donations to assist the country of Mozambique, whose small military has also been called in to rescue thousands of people from deadly catastrophic flooding that has displaced more than 150,000 people in this poverty-stricken nation. In the U.S., drought spreads and gets worse in Midwest and Plains states for the second year in a row. The U.S. Department of Agriculture this week declared much of the U.S. Wheat Belt a natural disaster area. In science, a fascinating new study in the journal Nature Climate Change suggests that waste heat from major metropolitan areas could raise temperatures in areas hundreds of miles away. The scientists say computer models show that excess heat generated by buildings and industries and cars, in theory, may actually be changing wind patterns in the upper atmosphere, affecting the direction of high-altitude winds like the jet stream.
Despite this history of unbridled generosity, in our hour of desperate need, we have been left waiting for help 6 times longer than the victims of Katrina.
That was New Jersey's Republican Governor Chris Christie a few weeks ago, slamming his fellow Republicans in Congress for delaying disaster and recovery funds for coastal areas devastated by Superstorm Sandy. Now, a full 3 months later, Congress on Monday finally passed a $50 billion emergency relief fund for storm victims to start rebuilding. All 36 votes in the U.S. Senate against disaster aid were from Republican senators, including some from the Gulf Coast states that received disaster aid after Hurricane Katrina.
Wow. Absolutely shameful.
Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood, the sole Republican in Obama's cabinet and a big proponent of high-speed rail, has announced on Monday he will step down as expected. Energy Secretary Stephen Shu is expected to step down soon, meaning that all cabinet positions dealing with the environment and energy will be open.
And it's going to be interesting to see if they ever get filled, given the pack of Republicans in there who can stop any presidential appointment they want here.
Finally, a new ad on Craigslist New York offered to pay $20 in cash to anyone willing to show up to an anti-wind protest at the British consulate in Midtown Manhattan to, quote, protest wind turbines being built in Scotland and England. The paid demonstration was postponed as soon as this story went viral. We don't know who was behind it, but
Donald Trump doesn't like the look of them.
They're ugly. They are in the most beautiful land and coast anywhere in the world. And if they allow this madness to continue, they will destroy Scotland.
Yes, New York developer Donald Trump is trying to kill an offshore wind farm near his proposed golf course in Scotland. Yes, Donald Trump, we're looking at you.
Oh, he would never do something so underhanded as to secretly hire protesters, would he?
No!
You're fired, Donald. For more on that story and all the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider a donation to help us celebrate the start of our 10th year at the Brad Blog. We've got some really cool premiums for you to check out, so stop on by and help us out to stay on your public airwaves. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Money, 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 money.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Agnes said for me to tell you that the dead air was on her. She didn't throw the third switch. But we did get the Green News Report in, which was good. Sorry about that. Thank you for hanging about. We are live from Capitol Hill. We are Skype only for conversation radio. Bob Kincaid Horn is the contact address, if it's not already in your Skype contacts. Bob Kincaid, BobKincaidHorn, and that gets you to the show. Jump in if you want. You're more than welcome to. And tickled me pink to see the technology behaving as it should. I was I've been chatting a little bit with John Fox in our chat room, and we will tweak this a little bit. But the audio the audio is far better than it was last week before we made all the magic begin to work. Let's see. A couple of different places I wanted to go. Are you familiar with this story coming out of Arizona, Stan, about how in order to get a high school diploma out there, the Republicans are proposing a loyalty oath? Really? In order to receive a high school diploma, House Bill 2467, offered by Representative Bob Thorpe, with an E, of course, a Republican and a teabagger, wants the graduating seniors, really, to sign a loyalty oath. Here's what the proposed legislation does. Oh, by the way, this is one of those gun goobers who also wants a state law that'll keep anybody from enforcing any of them Obama, Kenyan, Muslim, communist, socialist, fascist, deep-seated hatred of white people, federal gun-grabbing laws. Yeah, he's one of those. Get a net. Beginning in the 2013-14 school year, that would be next fall, in addition to fulfilling the course of study and assessment requirements prescribed in this chapter being Chapter 7 of Title 15 of Section 1 of the Arizona Revised Statutes, before a pupil is allowed to graduate from a public high school in this state, the principal or head teacher of the school shall verify in writing that the pupil has recited the following oath. I, state your name, do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that I take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that I will well and faithfully discharge these duties, so help me God. You know, a slightly more paranoid individual would say that these graduating seniors were having a military oath pre-applied to them. Sounds like that, because that's very similar to the oath a person takes. Is it not? It's close. But it's that so help me. First of all this oathy business has its roots, and this is not the tinfoil hat portion of the program. Many people know that a lot of the founders were all wrapped up in Freemasonry. And I'm not one of those people, oh, it's the Illuminati and they secretly run the government. No. It's a nice little social club. You get all the way to the top of the pyramid and then you get our tiny cars and parades and raise money for the injured and burned children, which is nice. But all of this language, let's see, take this obligation freely without any mental blah, 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 blah. That's straight out of the Masonic ritual. It also shows up in fraternity oaths and, The funny thing is, though, as I've noted before, these right-wingers have never had an idea to call their own. That has any sort of spark of originality to it. We've dealt with this issue before. Oddly enough, I know about this because it's a Supreme Court case that had to do with some Jehovah's Witnesses in West Virginia in the 1940s. Whose religion forbids them swearing or taking oaths, and especially using the language, so help me God. But once again, we have the case of an idiotic teabagger who follows the Constitution that exists only in his own mind, you know, the Constitution that includes one nation under God and life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and you know, lots of stuff that's not actually in there. There is no language in the proposed legislation, for instance, to grant an exception to an atheist or an agnostic or a Jehovah's Witness or a Seventh-day Adventurer or any of those folks. Now, Representative Thorpe says he'll get around to amending it one of these days. He said, in that we had a tight deadline for dropping our bills, I was not able to update the language. Even though I want to encourage all of our students to understand and respect our Constitution and constitutional form of government, I do not want to create a requirement that students or parents may feel uncomfortable with. Buddy, forcing an oath on you, on anybody, that's uncomfortable. The American Civil Liberties Union has chimed in. the Arizona chapter, saying you can't require students to attend school and then require them to either pledge allegiance to the flag or swear this loyalty oath in order to graduate. It's a violation of the First Amendment. That's because some other brainless teabagger has also introduced a mandatory pledge of allegiance statute. Everybody from 1st through 12th grades, at least the kindergartners get a break, all students in 1st through 12th grades have to say the Pledge of Allegiance each day. That modifies a current law in Arizona, Stan, that says schools must set aside time for the pledge each day, but students may choose whether to participate. And even that is bullshit. Okay, class, we're going to say the Pledge of Allegiance. With all the filthy little godless heathens who don't want to say it, go ahead and leave the room. The beatings will commence as soon as we're done pledging. Right? Thank you, Margie. I'm gonna just get Margie giggling and make a laugh track for the show, I think. But no, we have been down this road. We know how stupid this is. Unutterably stupid. Stupid squared. Cubed. Pressed down and shaken together. We've been through the McCarthy era, which was parodied brilliantly by one of my favorite authors, Joseph Heller, in the brilliantly executed Catch-22. There's one of those moments in there. I know Horst will get a kick out of this. When fellow administrative officers expressed astonishment at Colonel Cathcart's choice of Major, Captain Black muttered that there was something funny going on. When they speculated on the political value of Major's resemblance to Henry Fonda, Captain Black asserted that Major really was Henry Fonda, and when they remarked that Major was somewhat odd, Captain Black announced that he was a communist. "They're taking over everything," he declared rebelliously. "Well, you fellas can stand around and let them if you want to, but I'm not going to. I'm going to do something about it. From now on, I'm going to make every son of a bitch who comes in my intelligence tent sign a loyalty oath, and I'm not going to let that bastard Major sign one even if he wants to." Almost overnight, the glorious loyalty oath crusade was in full flower, and Captain Black was enraptured to discover himself spearheading it. He'd really hit on something. All the enlisted men and officers on combat duty had to sign a loyalty oath to get their map cases from the intelligence tent, a second loyalty oath to receive their flak suits and parachutes from the parachute tent, a third loyalty oath for Lieutenant Balkington, the motor vehicle officer, to be allowed to ride from the squadron to the airfield in one of the trucks. Every time they turned around, there was another loyalty oath to be signed. They signed a loyalty oath to get their pay from the finance officer, to obtain their PX supplies, to have their hair cut by the Italian barbers. To Captain Black, every officer who supported his glorious loyalty oath crusade was a competitor, and he planned and plotted 24 hours a day to keep one step ahead. He would stand second to none in his devotion to country. When other officers had followed his urging and introduced loyalty oaths of their own, he went them one better by making every son of a bitch who came to his intelligence tent sign two loyalty oaths, then three, then four. Then he introduced the Pledge of Allegiance, and after that, the Star Spangled Banner. One chorus, two choruses, three choruses, four choruses. Each time Captain Black forged ahead of his competitors, he swung upon them scornfully for their failure to follow his example. Each time they followed his example, he retreated with concern and racked his brain for some new stratagem that would enable him to turn upon them scornfully again. Without realizing how it had come about, the combat men in the squadron discovered themselves dominated by the administrators appointed to serve them. They were bullied, insulted, harassed, and shoved about all day long by one after the other. When they voiced objection, Captain Black replied that people who were loyal would not mind signing all the loyalty oaths they had to anyone who questioned the effectiveness of the loyalty oaths. He replied that people who really did owe allegiance to their country would be proud to pledge it as often as he forced them to. And to anyone who questioned the morality, he replied that the Star Spangled Banner was the greatest piece of music ever composed. The more loyalty oaths a person signed, the more loyal he was. To Captain Black, it was as simple as that, and he had Corporal Kolodny sign hundreds with his name each day so that he could always prove that he was more loyal than anyone else. The important thing is to keep them pledging, he explained to his cohorts. It doesn't matter whether they mean it or not. That's why they make the little kids pledge allegiance even before they know what pledge and allegiance means. To Captain Pilchard and Captain Wren, the glorious loyalty oath crusade was a glorious pain in the ass, since it complicated their task of organizing the crews for each combat mission. Men were tied up all over the squadron, signing, pledging, and singing, and the missions took hours longer to get underway. Effective emergency action became impossible, but Captain Pilchard and Captain Wren were both too timid to raise any outcry against Captain Black, who scrupulously enforced each day the doctrine of continual reaffirmation that he had originated. A doctrine designed to trap all those men who had become disloyal since the last time they had signed a loyalty oath the day before. It was Captain Black who came with advice to Captain Pilchard and Captain Wren as they pitched about in their bewildering predicament. He came with a delegation and advised them bluntly to make each man sign a loyalty oath before allowing him to fly on a combat mission. Of course, it's up to you, Captain Black pointed out. Nobody's trying to pressure you, but everyone else is making them sign loyalty oaths, and it's going to look mighty funny to the FBI if you two are the only ones who don't care enough about your country to make them sign loyalty oaths, too. If you want to get a bad reputation, that's nobody's business but your own. All we're trying to do is help. Milo was not convinced and absolutely refused to deprive Major Major of food, even if Major Major was a communist, which Milo secretly doubted. Milo was by nature opposed to any innovation that threatened to disrupt the normal course of affairs. Milo took a firm moral stand and absolutely refused to participate in the glorious loyalty oath crusade until Captain Black called upon him with his delegation and requested him to. National defense is everybody's job, Captain Black replied to Milo's objection. And this whole program is voluntary, Milo. Don't forget that. The men don't have to sign Pilchard and Wren's loyalty oath if they don't want to, but we need you to starve them to death if they don't. It's just like Catch-22, don't you get it? You're not against Catch-22, are you? Doc DiNico was adamant. What makes you so sure Major Major is a communist? You never heard him denying it until we began accusing him, did you? And you don't see him signing any of our loyalty oaths. You aren't letting him sign any. Of course not, Captain Black explained. That would defeat the whole purpose of our crusade. Look, you don't have to play ball with us if you don't want to, but what's the point of the rest of us working so hard if you're going to give Major Major medical attention the minute Milo begins starving him to death? I just wonder what they're going to think up at group about the man who's undermining our whole security program. They'll probably transfer you to the Pacific. Dr. Nika surrendered swiftly. I'll go tell Gus and Wes to do whatever you want them to. Up at group, Colonel Cathcart had already begun wondering what was going on. Is that idiot Black off on a patriotism binge, Colonel Korn reported with a smile. I think you'd better play ball with him for a while, since you're the one who promoted Major Major to squadron commander. That was your idea, Colonel Cathcart accused him petulantly. I never should have let you talk me into it. And a very good idea it was, too, retorted Colonel Korn, since it eliminated that superfluous major that's been giving you such an awful black eye as an administrator. Don't worry, this will probably run its course soon. The best thing to do now is send Captain Black a letter of total support and hope he drops dead before he does too much damage. Colonel Korn was struck with a whimsical thought. I wonder, you don't suppose that imbecile will try to turn Major Major out of his trailer, do you? The next thing we've got to do is turn that bastard Major Major out of his trailer, Captain Black decided. I'd like to turn his wife and kids out into the woods, too, but we can't. He has no wife and kids. So we'll just have to make do with what we have and turn him out. Who's in charge of the tents? He is. You see? They're taking over everything. Well, I'm not going to stand for it. I'll take this matter right to Major Blank de Coverley himself if I have to. I'll have Milo speak to him about it the minute he gets back from Rome. To get out of high school in Arizona, these right-wing fascists want to compel a loyalty oath. But rest assured, it's already going the way of Catch-22. Because now that they've added the loyalty oath, like I mentioned, they're adding in the Pledge of Allegiance. Once again, for children who don't even know what either pledge or allegiance means. You know, first graders, second graders. Arizona. Joe Arpaio, who has his own little cadre of gun thugs cruising the schools now. It's once they get past the Pledge of Allegiance, really, the next thing is to suggest that they need to work the radial arm saw in shop with one hand over their heart. Right? Yeah. Or maybe, I don't know, is it even patriotic to render the Pledge of Allegiance into Spanish? Or does that sort of de facto mean it's not a Pledge of Allegiance anymore? Oh, they'll be pledging and loyalty oathing. How about basketball and football games? That'd be a great time for a loyalty oath, wouldn't it? Jesus, the stupid, it burns. It hurts as us. Who said that the other night? Is that Michael? Let's go to the Skype line. I think we've got Sandra. Hey there, Sandra.
Hello?
Hey.
How did I hear the echo? Maybe you sorted it out.
It should sort of. Yeah, it's that thing where Skype learns itself.
Yeah. All right. So you were in Sin City by the Bay, huh?
Yes, I was.
Yeah. No. Is that your first time there?
Yeah, first time.
Listen, you really got to see how the other half lived, didn't you?
Yes.
San Francisco's a beautiful city. People just don't know until they get there. They're like, "What the hell?" Yeah, it's outrageous.
Yeah, but you know what kind of blew me away is that, you know, what makes it so wonderful is you've got a few million people minding their own business.
Oh, no, I lived there for years. I mean, San Francisco is a wonderful place. I'm sure you had all kinds of good times. I mean, everywhere you turn, you know, it's, if you're a thinking progressive, that's like ground zero.
Well, and I admit to a little, well, not a little bit, Sandra, but a whole bunch of country mouse come to the city because I walked out of that oyster place and went, smells like pot.
Oh, yeah.
And somebody standing in line to get into the oyster place looked at me and said, well, it is. And I said, sorry, not from around here. Never mind. Forget I said anything.
Oh, no. I mean, you know, it's, yeah. Yeah, everything goes on in San Francisco, but, you know, shame about the rents.
Oh.
You know, I mean, it's very expensive, sort of, too expensive to, but, you know, if you are able to live there, yeah, it's It's a really nice place. Did you go? You said you went to Muir Woods.
Yeah, I went to Muir Woods.
Oh yeah, that whole area is just mind blowing. I don't know if you got to Stinson Beach or any further down. But
no, I didn't get down to Stinson Beach, but you know we could see the Pacific. We passed a high point where we could look back and see the Pacific. It's like holy crap.
Yeah, no. It's that part of California is fantastic. It's the Muir Woods are amazing though. Yeah, that's a nice place.
Well, it really did. It felt like church.
Yeah, I mean, the vibe there, if I may use that word, is pretty incredible. I mean, it actually can be applied to that place. It's pretty, magical.
Oh, and
where else did you go over there? Just the city in there? Or?
Yeah, rode a couple of cable cars, looked around a little bit, walked down into Chinatown.
Did you go to the Mission, or did you stay in a more touristy area?
No, I was up on Van Ness, up above Polk Gulch.
Oh, you went there. Okay, yeah, so that's pretty standard. Yeah, no, you didn't get to Dolores Park, no?
No. I've got plenty of reason to go back.
Oh, no, I mean, you can only see so much for sure, but you went down to Embarcadero, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's where all the people were singing and dancing for choice.
Well, at least you didn't encounter one of them hideous critical mass days where you get run over by all the bikes. it's easy to take the piss out of San Francisco too, but it's a great place, you know. Did you go down to Castro?
No, you didn't.
Oh shit, that's a must. That's like Disneyland for fat queers. It's great.
No, it blew my mind. There was a little consignment, but a little thrift store down from the hotel that was just called, I took a picture and I sent it off to our good friend Peter Godbold and he thought it was just delightful. It was just a little thrift store called, Out of the Closet, the world's most fabulous thrift store. It was painted pink and purple, so I took a picture of it and sent it to Peter and he wrote back and he said, and it is fabulous. And he said just after a little while in San Francisco, he said, doesn't it just feel right? And I wrote, oh yeah, because one of the things I noticed was that you'd see these gay couples walking along the street and they're holding hands and they're looking lovingly into each other's eyes, and then a little bit later there's a hetero couple that comes by and they're just kind of walking sullenly, you know, nobody's holding hands, nobody's looking at each other. I mean, there were lessons to be had there.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's, for gay folks, it's just kind of stunning what's there for everyone, for sure. I mean, it's just a nice town. I mean, who wouldn't want to live in, San Francisco? I mean, it's just a really fantastic place and, it's always nice, the girls, when they go there, they love it. I mean, it's so diverse. It's just wonderful.
Well, and that's the thing. It's diverse and it's accepting and it's open and it's non-repressive. It's everything that scares a redneck half to death.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, the takeaway from San Francisco is that it's just really expensive. That's, and the housing is kind of hellish. But, there's a lot of stuff going on there. And then the greater Bay Area is just nice, too. I mean, Sausalito, Marin, all that over there is crazy nice.
I got to go up into a little town on Sunday night called Mill Valley.
Yeah, Mill Valley. Yeah, I mean, that's like, they have an amazing sort of art scene. I don't know if you noticed, but, yeah. And it's, that's some really that's a high income area over there, Marin.
Oh, I got the idea. I saw one sign in a window there. It was like a bookstore or something. And it just said, unattended children will be given an espresso and a free puppy. And I took a snapshot of that and sent it back to Agnes, and she hasn't quit laughing yet.
Well, there's Sausalito with the boats, houseboats, and Tiburon with these amazing, housing. It's crazy. And the Bay, I don't know, you know, I don't know if you managed to get on a boat.
Yeah, I did. Tom, our buddy here in the Horn family, came over and picked me up on Sunday morning, and we drove back across the Bay Bridge over to Richmond, and we went out in his sailboat and toddled around the bay a little bit. Oh, it was magnificent.
Oh, yeah, that's always good. No, that's amazing to do, you know, to look at the, to be in the bay there, because it's, yeah.
Well, it's the closest I've ever been to a seal or a sea lion, and most of the sea birds, too, for that matter.
Oh, yeah, well, all those critters, they got a lot of attitude around there, too. Yeah, well, that's good. That sounds like a good trip.
Oh, it was. It was. Every last bit of it was... I mean, yeah, it was a sad occasion to go out for the memorial, but even the memorial itself was far more of a celebration than an expression of grief.
Yeah. That's good. I'm glad that, it was worthwhile.
Well, it was, and like I said, it's easier. I found it easier to talk about, you know, the issues that affect Appalachia. I found it easier to talk about them out there than it is to talk about it to somebody, you know, down at the Rippy Mart 2 miles from home.
Yeah. Well, listen.
The first thing people, you know, when I explained the blasting and everything that goes on, somebody looked at me and said, "Man, if they were doing that on top of Mount Tam, there'd be a war on." And I was like, "Yeah, okay. Yeah, you get it. Yeah, you wouldn't tolerate it. Why do we have to?"
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, as you see, Callum, we like our state out here, and you see why.
Yeah. Believe me, I understand why apparently the whole world wants to go there.
Well, and I don't know, someone mentioned, I just kind of caught it, I wasn't listening too closely, but they mentioned Kings Canyon. Yeah, listen, that is the best-kept secret on the damn planet. If you do get out here to see Kings Canyon National Park, oh, my God, it's an amazing place. I thought it was more impressive than Yosemite, and it's not as well known. But the canyon itself is actually deeper than the Grand Canyon.
I mean, it has that. I've never even heard of this place.
Yeah, it's an amazing place. It's crazy, and it's only like 2.5-3 hours away from where I am right now. And I just went to it like. Maybe 6 years ago for the first time. It's unbelievable. I can't recommend that place more.
Well, it's funny. There's a or not funny, but there's a whole bunch of people who aren't from California who are chiming in. Gene, who's all the way across the pond now, says, "Yeah, that's how I felt about Berkeley, Bob." And I get it now. I really, really get it.
Oh yeah, you didn't even get over to the East Bay. No, I mean that's a whole different. Yeah, I mean it's just
no,
lot.
But we were, you know, on the way over to get on the boat. Tom was pointing out. He says, "Yeah," and he said, "And Richard's up in those hills up there somewhere," and he said, "Yeah," and so the entire Horn family was thought of while we were out on that boat.
Yeah, well. You know,
your name got taken in vain a couple of times.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, Sacramento is a far cry from the Bay Area, but it has its high points, too. So.
Well, I think the whole state does.
And
then the only unnerving thing about it was the actual flight in, because, you know, you finally cross over the Rockies and the Sierras and everything, and you come down to land at SFO, and it's like, you know, I really hope this is our approach and we're not just about to crash into the water. Because, I mean,
yeah.
they ain't no land. It's all wet.
No. It is always it always is interesting flying back into that airport. What did you think of that airport anyway?
It wasn't bad. It wasn't bad at all.
I find it's one of the better ones that I've been to.
I got through
U.S.
on the way out. I got through security, no problem. People were friendly. You know, the TSA wasn't surly. People were talking to each other on the streets out there. I mean, you know, most of the times in an eastern city, you keep your eyes on the ground. You don't make eye contact, and you know, because God knows what might happen. That
oh,
was
no, you don't. San Francisco, you don't do nothing but watch people there. Are you kidding me? That's like the price of admission. It's free and it's fun.
Exactly. Exactly.
And, no, no.
You know, meanwhile, I had a cable car driver who gave me the history of the city and told me, you know, and told me all about, you know, how Dianne Feinstein almost killed the cable cars. And I get the idea she's not loved.
Oh, no, no. That's the thing. That's why, you know, when you hear me talking about her, I'm like, A, I'm scared because of the whole thing with the Harvey Milk Moscone thing. She was hella suspect how she took over everything, you know, Alexander Haig style. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, I'm in charge here.
Right. It was that kind of party. And, you know, I mean, I hope listeners know who the hell that guy is. I know it's been a while.
No, I think everybody does. But
yeah. Okay, because he's a special person in our history. But, yeah, she has a lot of detractors, and, you know, she needs to go away. Hopefully she won't be running again.
Because, yeah, it's fairly safe to say that you'll probably get somebody better.
Well, I mean, she is for a Democrat, just, you know, not – yeah, she's been terrible to me.
And, you know, I realized that Jerry Brown was the governor. I didn't realize that Gavin Newsom is the lieutenant governor.
Oh, yeah, he got big plans for himself.
Well,
so
and
we'll see.
Yeah, there could be worse people to have plans.
Yeah, no, I'm just saying he's known to be ambitious. So, you know, he's putting himself in that place right along with Kamala Harris, whatever her name is.
Yeah.
She also has the attorney general, she also has other, you know, state ambitions. And, you know, Jerry Brown is 72, so there's a good possibility that he's not going to be trying to run again. So we'll see. Although, you know, Jerry Brown, he don't mess around. I mean, dude has managed to, quote, balance the budget here, which is, you know, everyone's in a state of shock and shit. So he kind of knows what he's doing.
Yeah, and gone are the days of all that Governor Moonbeam stuff.
Oh no, he's a fairly kind of Cuomo type of governor. You understand what I'm saying? He's I don't want to say he's a neoliberal, but he is more that way than Moonbeam now. That's
yeah.
For sure.
Well,
you know, I mean Jerry Brown, you know, he's a character, but he certainly has had some success with this run. At least as far as the budget's concerned. You know, I mean, I still can't get over how he beat the hell out of that rich bitch. That was excellent.
Well,
it was a clinic. He put a clinic on for her.
Yeah, and, well, it didn't hurt that she was a freaking idiot. You talking about what, Meg Whitman? Or?
Oh, yeah, but, I mean, it was just the idea that he just really didn't. I think he spent, like, a fraction of what she did and just blew her out the water. I mean, it was just pathetic at the end. So, you know.
But now, of course, I'm sitting here opining after a 3-day trip to San Francisco. I'm still, you know, certainly no expert. Now I got to see the southern end of the state.
Yeah, well, it's different, you know. I mean, and don't get me wrong, I really enjoy parts of Southern California, especially San Diego. San Diego is a fantastic city. I don't care what they say about the military. It's a fantastic city. And if you go further up north, San Clemente, Hearst Castle, that part of California?
Yeah.
Outrageous. It's like my favorite part. It's great. It's great down there. Yeah.
And then I got a note from our buddy Roger, who said, you need to get 100 miles north of San Francisco and see the real Northern California.
Mm.
So.
Well, yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, you know, there really is so much to, you know, to see in California. That's for sure. So. That's good. I'm glad you finally had a chance to come out and.
Well, I hope we get back. I hope we get back out for Netroots Nation because that would be more time and we could really build in some fun. I think.
Oh yeah, you just a hop skip to Santa Cruz, which is a nice place, and all that area down there, the Big Sur and stuff. Because isn't the Netroots in San Jose?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, San Jose is like the gateway to, you know, you can get to. Central, you know, Central Coast pretty easily from there.
But the whole, the whole thing was just breathtaking. And I had a couple of folks out there saying, you know, we need to get you out here for a week, 2 weeks, and, you know, really, really, really start telling people what's going on back east.
Yeah. You come out here too much, you'll be saying, Virginia, what?
Yeah. West where?
Yeah, I mean, you know, huge amounts of people are transplants in California. I mean, I actually was born here, but loads of people weren't, you know, so it's that kind of place.
Yeah, I asked somebody, I said, well, are you from here? And he looks at me and goes, come on, is anybody from here?
Exactly. I mean, there is that, there is an element to that, but,
But,
you know,
yeah,
I mean, it's not like a Florida type of thing where people come to retire per se, but, you know.
Well, and you know, it was kind of cute because a couple of the cable cars I saw were all festooned in, scarlet and gold Niners colors. And
that's right, of course.
Yeah. The bars had lots of, so, yeah, people are into that and they're psyched up and stoked for the, and a lot of Giants, you know, a lot of Giants memorabilia hanging on the walls. And, yeah, the bars, you know what blew my mind? The bars are tiny. I mean, they're just very narrow little affairs. It don't hurt many people at all.
Space is, premium. But there's some amazing bars in San Francisco, though. Oh my goodness. Did you go to the Haight-Ashbury at all?
Nope, didn't get there either. No, my time was pretty tightly scripted.
No, I understand. That's but it's just on the strength of anything to get up there. It's hilarious. Anyway.
No, I had a constant soundtrack running through my mind of Grateful Dead music and Grace Slick screaming, "We built this city," and
oh no.
Yeah, it's pretty awful.
Oh, no, I mean, I lived in the Upper Haight, which is, when you say that, that's, you know, further up towards the Golden Gate, to the park. But I was in the early 80s, you know, so it wasn't too far removed from when it, shit was crazy. But, yeah. That just has me thinking about San Francisco now. But that's a great place.
Well, I'm getting hell in the chat room for not having made it down to Fisherman's Wharf and.
The list is kind of endless. So you should just say, oh, it's only one damn trip. For how many hours were you there for?
Oh no, I got there Friday and I was out of there Monday morning.
Mm. Oh well, anyway, so I suppose. I do have an issue. I was kind of a bit, not surprised, but kind of taken back by the total lack of any sort of filibuster change. Can you believe that?
Yeah, it was just.
I mean, I just said I don't want to hear about Obama's plans for anything now because in the lieu of that and the recess court decision, what the hell kind of term is he going to have?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, it's was anybody out there actually trying to delude themselves, Sandra, into thinking that Harry Reid was going to do something strong?
Well, no. But it's just the thing is that it's. You know, I just mean if Obama is concerned about his legacy, which most second-term presidents are in some form, he's going to have to just run a complete game for 4 years because any major legislation he hopes to put through, unless they change it in 2014, I mean, how is it going to happen?
I don't see anything. I don't see anything changing the state of gridlock as it now stands. You know, all of this, and I'm sorry for being the cynic that I am, but all of this talk about immigration reform, and I stand by my prediction that the firearms issues will go unsolved, and we'll just continue to tolerate the occasional handful of kitties being blown to bits.
Oh, I mean, no.
Because this. Because remains an utterly and entirely dysfunctional Congress.
No, I mean, you know, Obama's, if his interviews are any indication, he's kind of still in la-la land because he seems to think that there's going to be some sort of self-evaluating or reflecting or some bullshit on their part. When didn't he see Mitch McConnell say, how we beat the liberals? He didn't see that memo?
Right.
You know, that was Mitch McConnell, and she's doing exactly what she plans to do, and they're not going to do anything but filibuster whatever the hell they want.
Right, because you know, what were the elements of this that it makes it a little easier to get district court judges confirmed, but certainly not circuit court judges or Supreme Court justices? No, that game is still on. I'm amazed that they managed to confirm John Kerry today.
Well, yeah, I suppose, I guess. I mean, what happened with Hagel? I mean, to be honest, Bob, I've kind of took a step back because after hearing, you know, that gibberish from Obama about climate change, you know, I'm just sort of holding off because if he okays that pipeline, then it's doubly BS, you know? Now, maybe most people don't realize that, but there is a connection on his rhetoric and the Keystone. If he says, no, we can't do it, then I'm back on board. I'll be honest with you. I'm willing to go there. If he comes out and says, we cannot do this because blah, 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 it's not good for the future of the earth, then I'm happy to back off on my constant criticism of Obama. But if he okays it, then we know what time it is. I'm sorry, I'm using just that one decision.
Well, I've done something similar. You know, before the November elections, I said there's a lot of things I'd like to see done better, but if the bombs start raining on Iran, that's a deal breaker for me. But I understand where you are on this. What disturbs me, though, is that, you know, they've got this, and it's not the fact that they've got this rally plan that disturbs me. I'm behind that. I support it. I'm all for it. Because Bill McKibben and 350, supported by the Sierra Club, are, you know, calling for literally tens of thousands of people here in Washington, D.C. on February the 17th to demand that the Keystone XL pipeline be 86th.
Well, the Sierra Club, isn't this the first time in their history that they've okayed some, you know, quote, radical action? I say that in quotes because it's not that radical, but it's radical for them.
Yeah, this is the first time they will have done actual potential for arrest civil disobedience stuff.
Well, I mean, we got the whole first, well, what's left of the First Peoples in Canada going buck wild. I mean, you know, I know we don't hear about it on, you know.
Oh, no, I'm following. I'm following the Idle No More movement very, very closely.
Pretty, you know, that to me is, yeah, that's an interesting kind of process that's going on in Canada. I mean, it's been one social movement after another in Canada, back to back to back, you know, so. I'm just curious. I'm really concerned because they've kicked the decision down until April now, right? Is that the latest?
Yeah, it is. And I guess that's to give the incoming secretary time to get his head around it.
Well, I did hear that him and his ketchup bitch disinvest, you know, from their various energy stock holdings.
Oh, yeah.
Him and Teresa, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, the divestiture.
Yeah.
Here's my little moment of cynicism, Sandra. If they've pushed the decision back to April, that just gives the poisoners and the frackers and the blasters and the drillers that much more time to apply a few more twists on the economic thumbscrews.
Well, and also with Kerry taking his money out of the extraction companies, it also allows him to say, well, I'm not invested in any of this either. So he could use it to decide either way. You see what I mean? So I don't know what to make of it, but you're suggesting that because he's not deciding now, it doesn't bode well, right?
it makes me nervous. I guess my question, Sandra, is what more data do we need to make a decision on this?
Well, yeah, I don't know, but, you know, there's some crazy ass weather going on if that data helps.
But see, the other thing that made my little ears perk up is that the whole issue over the Keystone XL pipeline got a lot of impetus from the fact that a Republican governor, the governor of Nebraska, was one of the first ones to raise an issue with it, to take issue with it because of its path through, what, the Ogallala Aquifer? And now he issued an announcement, last week saying, it's been rerouted. He's good to go on the Keystone XL pipeline. Let's build it and get the jobs.
Right. From what I can tell, the number of jobs is so minuscule compared to the externalities. It's like laughable. I don't understand. I mean, are they just, you know, is it just straight up obfuscation? Are you just lying to, you know, because the jobs are like a couple of thousand, and then I heard a few hundred permanent ones once it's built. I mean, I didn't hear that it was loads of jobs. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
Well, no, it's,
Wait, hold on for a minute.
Got it.
Hey, close the door. Sorry.
That's okay. Parenthood, man. I know. I get it. But the jobs are always the big lie, whether it's mountaintop removal in Appalachia or fracking or the Keystone XL pipeline or blowing up the Pinoki Hills in Wisconsin. For instance, the Wisconsin case, the original statement was that there would be 35 not local jobs that were brought into the area and that maybe there'd be 35 more. Well, the last I checked, now they're up to, there'll be 8,000 jobs if we can just poison all this water. And it's how they always operate, Sandra. You know, there's not going to be shit for jobs.
Well, no, exactly. And they still have the people fooled that this is going to increase our independence when all it's going to do is ship that nasty stuff to the global markets.
Right. Yeah.
And the people don't understand that. They seem to believe that this pipe means something for us.
Because I guess we're going to go back to 99-cent a gallon gasoline.
No, it's incredible.
Did you see that photograph of Beijing that was circulating the internet that went all viral last week?
Listen, I got a friend who's going to Beijing on Thursday, and I'm like, dude, you got some oxygen? You know what I'm saying? That just looked crazy.
Well, the caption I saw was, "This is not a screen capture from Blade Runner."
I shouldn't laugh. I mean, it's horrible.
Because it looked exactly like it. Remember when Blade Runner came out and that sort of permanent twilight darkness that just pervades the film was gloomy. And you're thinking, yeah, well, maybe 500 years down the road. Well, no, it turned out it was just 40.
Well, I heard today that there's another, can we call it, smog front on the way.
Right.
And that's not, if it's supposed to be at the numbers they talked about, I don't know what the measurement was, but normally it's 50. They were saying it was 800.
Yeah.
So I wish I had the measurement.
Well, and remember, those clouds that are being generated, that smog that's being generated in China is visible from space as a toxic yellow cloud that blows all the way across the Pacific and lands on y'all. And that was one of those things that I got to talk to people in California about while I was there. I said, you've got a dog in this hunt back in Appalachia because our coal is getting on boats and going to China and coming back to you.
The whole sort of, what was I listening to, or somebody was talking about the soot and all of that actually landing on the ice, the glaciers and the snowpacks and contributing to warming too.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, anybody who's ever lived in a cold climate knows that one of the things they like to do when the roads are icy is they put cinders on them. Well, that's carbon. That's stuff from burning stuff, and it melts the ice. I mean, I remember when, what was it, a couple of years ago when the Missouri River froze so solid because it was got pretty cold winter. And the geniuses were actually dumping coal ash on the frozen Missouri River to melt the ice so the barges could get through.
Well, I mean,
and that's coal ash with concentrations of arsenic and mercury and cadmium and barium and selenium and all kinds of just mind-bendingly high up above the tolerable standards as promulgated by the EPA.
Well, once again, because people don't have an idea, they think about global warming, they always think about, oh, well, if it's snowing, then the global warming isn't working. But apparently, there's been these sort of frozen cyclones that's been going on since winter that are sort of freaking out scientists, too. You know, just the weather, the extreme winter-type weather is also a byproduct of the climate change, you know?
Yeah.
But hasn't it been like 70 degrees now? Almost 80?
Yeah. Look, I was all bummed out yesterday because I was laughing at people who were saying, well, it might be a little chilly here in San Francisco. I'm like, dude, I'm halfway to running around in my boxer shorts. It's so warm here. You people don't know what cold is. And then, so I'm getting on the plane, I'm all bummed out, because I'm going to be flying back in the teeth of something evil. You want to know what it was here in Washington, D.C. today, Sandra?
Oh, God, what?
It was 72 degrees and not a cloud in the sky.
Well, it's 77 in Kansas, 74 in Missouri. Hello? That's a bit special, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, anyway,
the robins are all out in the trees here and just chirping, and two more days of this and the tulips will come up.
Well, we had this horrific cold snap out here, which was one of those 20-year freezing where they were worried about the billion-dollar oranges,
Oh yeah.
So it was pretty bad out. I mean, I was like complaining because I couldn't, go on my bike ride.
Well,
nothing worse than a Californian bitching about weather, but
yeah, yeah, but at least you're honest enough to be open about it.
Well, anyway, I don't really have anything else. Like I said, I have really disengaged because I'm so through with, just can't deal with it. So.
Oh, I get it. While we were talking, Ron sent in a note. Ron and Raleigh, he said, I don't know if you've heard, but today the U.S. set up a drone patrol in Niger. And he said, so like Sauron in The Lord of the Rings, the U.S. has cast its malevolent eye upon the continent of Africa.
Oh, no, that whole situation is so disturbing. And, that's a partial blowback from dear leader's glorious war in Libya.
Yeah, and did you catch that story? Because I know this cultural stuff kind of matters, and you see it frequently. Did you catch the story of from Mali and from Timbuktu of the so-called Al-Qaeda militants who torched the libraries on the way out of town?
Oh yeah, that shit was like something from
I mean, that was almost as bad as when we went into Baghdad and started smashing cuneiform tablets. Because it's so obvious when it's a terrible loss of cultural treasures. But I remember when the Taliban blew up the Bamiyan Buddhas and I was just incensed. But we act like this is something other people do when God knows how many, tablets bearing the very first writing that human beings ever did, careless soldiers rampaging through the Ministry of Culture in Baghdad
you know, literally return dust unto dust.
Your disconnection went really south there for a minute.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, Skype will usually sort itself out. Do I have you?
Yeah, no, it's a lot of static going on when you.
No, I don't know. I could have gotten loud. I may have been clipping or something.
The thing about Mali is, you know, and with the French being there, it's just kind of like they need to secure their uranium and, you know, get their gold. I mean, it's all really horrific. It's too much. But anyway, I'm going to let you go because this connection is kind of a dive.
All right. Well, Sandra, it's awful good to hear from you. Maybe we'll get out there yet and try to hang out a little bit. It sure would be fun.
Oh, yeah, next time for sure.
All right.
Bye, Bob.
Take care. Bye now.
Bye.
Calling from California, that's Sandra. Darlene sent in a note during the call. It was merely titled, Darlene's note was merely titled, Sandra-isms, LOL. I have a feeling that Darlene was laughing as she was typing. She said, him, meaning Carrie, and his ketchup bitch? That's hysterical. Just like Sandra's comment months ago regarding Governor Christie of New Jersey dropping a hundy to run for president. Thanks for the laughs, Sandra. And in regard to the mention made of Beijing, and if you haven't seen that photograph, go look up Beijing smog, Blade Runner. You'll see it's creepy. Because I remember seeing photographs of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in like 1912 at noon, because there's a clock in the photo. High noon on a sunny day, and it looks like night from the filth being poured into the air. See, that's what you get when so-called industrial revolutions ramp up. In the name of having whatever an industrial revolution brings, you are willing to sacrifice every last part of the social and political commons on the altar of capitalism. And people can holler communism all they want to in regard to China, but it just isn't. China is in absolute total capitalist free fall. And that's why Beijing looks like it does. Andy, another person I would have loved to have met out that way, didn't. It'll happen. He's in Redwood City, and he says, Beijing, China pollution is 8 times higher than the unhealthy level. It is beyond the level that is regarded as hazardous to one's health. But we have to understand that things like hazardous to health don't matter inside capitalist scheming. The only thing that matters is more money. It's pretty straightforward. All that matters is supporting the wealth generation system. And it doesn't allow for calculations of things like externalities, things like excess deaths, things like poisoned children, things like ruined ruined air, ruined water. Because the essence of capitalism is consumption. Isn't it interesting that the old antiquated word for tuberculosis was consumption? Yeah. Tim from L.A. writing in, subject line, smog front. Smog at 800 in Los Angeles, in the most smoggiest part of Los Angeles, in West San Fernando Valley. It's currently 26 on the air quality index, according to the AQMB. So we're saying lives is worse than Los Angeles because of China? Amazing. I remember as a child I could not play outside because my lungs hurt. Then because of stringent regulation, both at the state and federal level, our air was cleaned. And today, every couple of years, as a driver, I'm required to get a smog check for my low-emission Toyota. Still, I wonder, with all the smog coming from China, how many of the polluters are U.S. businesses in China killing off people like Sandra and their families? Poisoning. And those are externalities. Those are the kind of things that we want to calculate and the poisoners don't want us to. It's by calculating externalities, for instance, that we know that for every dollar that the coal industry brings to West Virginia, we as a state pay out five. It's a hell of an exchange rate, $1 for every five we pay. You can't sit at the poker table for long that way. Maybe this explains something, though. When I got out there, and in days gone by, I was a hell of a walker. Never cared much for running, but I can walk pretty damn fast anywhere I want to go. And we walked a lot of places out there. You know, up hills and down hills and stuff. Never got winded. Just and started absolutely flying, because I take a pretty damn long stride. And I wasn't thinking anything of it until I got back last night and Ferg looked at me. It's a long, tormented story. Where we park here, we park on the street. But before I left, we had to move the cars. Everybody had to move their car off the street parking because anti-abortion freak circus was coming to town. So they needed that entire street where this on-street parking was for police cruisers, rollers. So I had to go and park in Union Station. That was a $110 proposition. Oh, joy. So last night when I got back, Ferg and I walked down to Union Station to go get the car. And he's like, "Dad, why are you walking so fast?" I said, "I didn't know I was. This is how I always used to walk." He said, "That place must have been good for you." It was. It was. But Tim's point is very well taken. How many of the polluters that are pumping all that filth into China's air are U.S. concerns? And I will bet you it's in excess of 50%, and that the other 45% or 40% are probably other international concerns in a public-private partnership with the Chinese government, which isn't so much communism as it is fascism when you get right down to it, right? But again, China has made the decision that in order to build wealth, it will sacrifice its people. Because given the population of China, they've got population to lose. And in fascism, you don't really worry about calculating that kind of stuff. Some other emails rolling in. Ron and Raleigh writing in. He says, "I'm going back to Cali." Sandra's right. San Diego is a great city, much better away from the military base. My sister lived in San Clemente. If you get out there, you have to drive through La Jolla. I say drive through because you damn sure can't afford to stop. Irish Dave. John Kerry has a demonstrated history of being cowed. Like, he points out, not disputing the vote in Ohio. And is therefore acceptable to the villagers, Dave says. Being kin to Malcolm Forbes doesn't hurt either. As they say in Teresa's old hometown of Pittsburgh, we don't need to breathe no stinking air. Yeah. Jeremy, writing in from Burlington, Vermont, says, I figured this fits into the conversation. Vermont groups, residents seek tar sands pipeline input. It comes from a station in Vermont. The Portland Pipeline and its Sutton Pumping Station runs through the heart of the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont. 236-mile pipeline. It's been around since World War II. It pumps oil from Portland, Maine to Montreal. Neighbors of the pipeline are among those concerned. The company that owns it has plans to reverse the flow as part of a larger effort to find export markets for what he calls dirty Canadian tar sands oil. I don't even call it oil. I call it goo. A number of citizens are asking the Vermont Environmental Commission to step in before they can start running tar sands oil through Vermont. The request to the commission cites things like this. Tar sands poses a lot of threats to New England. In July of 2010, a tar sands pipeline burst in Kalamazoo, Michigan, spilling tar sands into Talmadge Creek and the Kalamazoo River. Because tar sands sinks instead of floats like conventional crude, EPA has estimated that even though $1 billion has been spent, or just short of $1 billion has been spent on the cleanup of that one relatively small so-called spill, it is likely that the river will, pay attention to this word, never be fully restored. Never. As in never ever. The oil industry, on the other hand, responds by saying, well, if the pipeline was to carry tar sands oil, it doesn't justify these people being all concerned. Right, because it's not about our lives, it's about their money. That's pretty easy, isn't it? Jeremy's with us. Hey, Jeremy, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
How's it going?
This?
Yeah.
Oh, good. You? Just figured I was chiming about that earlier. Section of the pipeline that goes up through...
Hey, Jeremy. Get your mic adjusted or something. We've got a bunch of noise going on.
Is that better?
A million times.
Okay, it's because it was in my pocket. I was going to say, that pipeline that I sent you that story about goes through northern Vermont and goes up into Maine, and then it goes into Montreal. The problem with it is that the company that owns it has connection to the other pipeline, and they're putting the things in places that they could reverse the flow and send the tar sands back from Montreal back into here. That's their fear. The company says they're not going to do it, but they put a bunch of things into places to make it appear that they're making the steps to do that.
It's creepy if it is.
And I wouldn't put it past them because it has the ability to do it. So... I don't know, but it is kind of creepy, and I just thought it was interesting that that popped up today out of all stories around here.
That's it. Well, at least it's creepy, but by the same token, the fact that it's popping up on your local media, Jeremy, at least indicates that there is there's a level of awareness that people are prepared to push back over.
Which I find ironic because the source that comes from is well-known for being right-leaning. Back when Dean was governor here, they really hated mentioning anything to him that was positive at all. They did it, they grinned and bared and did it, but you could tell they really didn't want to do it. And they do it to a very minimum if they could.
Sure.
So these are people that would be probably, for the most part, in disagreement with this news channel, but they're covering it because they have to.
Well, or else they're trying to do a preemptive strike, if you will.
Right, and I think they might have tried to do that and trying to paint some of these people as kind of like liberal loons, which they're not. I mean, they're all of sound mind. One of the guys in that story, I saw the actual video on the news tonight, when they interviewed him, he talked about, I want to say, the Black River, something like that, maybe the Snake River, I don't know, had said that the EPA disclosed a story about this place because a pipeline went through that river and blew up. And after $1 billion of a cleanup, they still said the river probably never restored to full potential again.
Yeah, that never thing had sort of resonance with me.
And that was tar sands, and they said that it sunk to the bottom. It doesn't float like oil, so they couldn't just scoop it up like everything else. Right. Not to mention it's piped in at a hot, it's like 90 degrees when they pump it through the things, too, if not more.
Right. Yeah, this is not crude. People need to understand that. I don't know how many people do. This is sludge. This is goo. This is, yeah.
And to change the subject for a second, last week I saw some people posting on social media some a picture of Obama, and next to it had a bunch of stuff. And at the bottom it basically said, remember Hitler's rise to power when they were threatening about him? Isn't it kind of concerned about Obama?
What?
I kind of had... Yeah, they're trying to compare Obama's rise to power to Hitler's rise to power.
Yeah,
these are the same people that are the gun nuts.
Right, because it's just the same.
That's what they're trying to get at. And basically, I mean, I threw out there to them, and the person that had posted this originally, it got deleted because so many people fired back at him. But I said, you people that spread this Hitler took the guns away by making laws to take them away myth are idiots.
Well, it's not even true. Actually,
no,
Adolf Hitler promoted gun ownership.
Right.
He didn't take the guns away. Neither did Fidel Castro.
In the laws he used, in the end, when he started taking arms away from people, were on the books before him and the Nazis even came to power.
Well, right. But, I mean, in large part, Adolf Hitler never disarmed the German people. It just didn't happen.
Right, so I mean, this is one of those things that just incenses me. I have lots of problems with Obama, clearly, we all do. But to say that he's Hitler in any way is above and below the pale. It's just not even close.
No, but that doesn't matter because they're speaking, Jeremy, inside an echo chamber in which each person who hears it in turn amplifies it until you've created this massive Obama is Hitler movement.
Right.
And at that point, it's utterly and completely, totally, absolutely divorced from anything resembling reality.
Right, and I understand that, but I had to say something back to these people and try to slow them down a little bit in their tracks because what they're saying is completely far from the truth, not even close. And like I said, I think this person got shocked enough by the people who were outraged and spoke out against it that he actually removed this post altogether, which is ironic because he works for the government.
Sure. No, there's no... I get that. Big time.
Right. And also, I don't know if you happen to see on your Facebook, I put on a picture there yesterday to show you what I'm dealing with here, too. These same people saying that liberal thinking is that we shouldn't look at... Muslims enemy, which we shouldn't, not all of them anyway, that we shouldn't look at the guys who've been doing shootings around here in the States as enemies because there's nothing wrong with them. That picture right there also annoyed me.
Look, we're up to our eyeballs in just plain old-fashioned, no two ways about it, crazy right now. Jeremy, just crazy. And again, I mean, look, one of the stories that I had stacked up for this evening was the, here it is. The father of one of the Sandy Hook victims. Did you see this story?
The one said that we shouldn't have knee-jerk reactions even though his kids were killed.
No. He was speaking... giving testimony at the Connecticut General Assembly, the legislature, a guy named Neil Heislin. His son was killed at Newtown Elementary School. And he said at one point, I just don't know why we have to have 100-round magazines. And a bunch of teabagging, knuckle-walking, mouth-breathing gun goober and freaks in the audience stood up and screamed, "The Second Amendment," and started heckling a man whose son was chewed to pieces by a semi-automatic rifle in an elementary school.
Actually, I heard about this guy. It's similar to the school, the retired guy that was near the school, and the kids ran to it, and they're trying to say he's a false flag plant. Same type of thing.
Yeah, just unmitigated evil. So
right, and I mean, I remember because this guy, not just him, but I've heard from other media sources that these kids were literally sliced to pieces. Actually, were cut up by bullets.
Yes, yes, stitched.
Right, literally were cut to pieces by these bullets.
Okay, because these brave, bold, hyper-American patriots, they're going to protect us from the government being tyrannical, or I can't even say it with a straight face, Jeremy, and they're going to do that by heckling a man who is down in the depths of the most agonizing grief that any human being on the planet can possibly imagine. That's how they're protecting our freedom, right?
I'm in total agreement with you. I can't say things like that with a straight face either, thinking that people think that they're going to turn our military on us and take away our guns. I can't even say it because it makes me want to laugh. It's just, it's unfeasible. I just don't ever see it happening as bad as things can get around here.
It was, on the one hand, you want to say, well, you know, that's how they are, and just sort of chalk it up to them being poorly raised, ill-mannered, ignorant. But then you have to take into account that these people have lots of guns and would like to find a time when they can use them.
Yeah, most of these people have dreams of killing intruders coming out of their house and going out in a blaze of glory, saving their family, which is very unlikely even in the worst of circumstances again, too. I think it was probably Friday night's program. Malloy was talking about guns, and he said that he and Cavi had been robbed 3 times. Once severely, the 2 other times were lesser, but one of the times he actually caught the guy. I don't think you hear Mike Malloy saying he shot and killed this guy, and Mike has a concealed carry permit.
Right. Right, exactly.
So, and I mean, he alluded to that. He said it's a story of another time, but obviously he didn't shoot and kill this guy.
No, but you've got gun goobers out there, Jeremy, who yearn for the day when they get to blow away a human being because they deem they've been threatened. You know, I got to thinking about all this in sort of a bubble off plum different light the other night. I had that one story, I guess last week, that just really got all over me. The woman who had to go to a clinic to be delivered of a baby that had already died inside her, and all the anti-abortion freaks that were singing "Happy Birthday, Dead Baby" to her as she walked into the building. I wonder if these Christians have ever considered the possibility that in states like Texas, where they do this, and states like Mississippi, where they do this, and states like Florida, where they engage in this behavior, these anti-abortion fascist phony baloney followers of their imaginary Jesus. I wonder if they've ever considered that maybe one of those women one of these days might be put in fear of immediately being harmed, at which point she would pull out her weapon and begin blowing away and sending to heaven all of these followers of Jesus who are screaming at her. You know what? I think that something would change right quick if that happened. Not advocating it, but I am acknowledging it because, you know, this put in fear business that the stand and blaze laws in places like Florida have enabled. You know what? Those laws apply to everybody, not just paranoid people like George Zimmerman when they decide that they're or some other guy who wants to blow away a kid sitting and listening to music that the guy doesn't approve of. No, I want to be careful in how I say this.
because I am nonviolent. But maybe that's what they count on. They count on us being nonviolent. But the story out of Huntsville, Alabama, said that the woman's husband had to be physically restrained to keep him from going and knocking the snot out of some friends of Jesus when they were singing happy birthday, dead baby, to his wife carrying their child that had died inside her.
That's completely disgusting, and so is this new law that's being out west that's being proposed that you can't abort a baby even if it's of a rape, because if you do that, you're destroying criminal evidence.
Yeah, that's New Mexico.
That's just freaking insane. Nobody is pro-abortion. They're pro-women's choice, but nobody's pro-abortion for killing babies if it's needlessly done. Nobody's for that. So you throw in this law, like, just insert the injury, basically. It's another one of those, well, you have too short a skirt on. It's your fault laws. That's all it is.
Yeah. And, the New Mexico case just drives me nuts, Jeremy, because the idea that a human being, but that's not the only one. That's not the only one. Let's see here. You know, there's another one out of Arkansas today. Arkansas wants to do. Arkansas wants to imprison mothers and doctors. They've got a proposed law out in Arkansas that would put doctors in jail who perform an abortion after six weeks in pregnancy. Well, you can't even know if you're pregnant at six weeks.
Right.
I mean, if you figure out you're pregnant at 6 weeks, you're already 6 weeks pregnant. Does that make sense? Yeah.
No. Yeah. Perfectly. I was gonna, in terms of like more gun stuff here for a second, not to draw things out, but I distinctly remember a story from within the last, I'd say, 7 years out of Texas with a guy who came home and had two, he assumed, immigrants running out of his house who had been robbing him while he was gone. He got in the house, called 911, chased the people out of the house. 911, same as Zimmerman, told him, cease and assist, don't do anymore, the police are on their way. And he said, no, I'm going to shoot them. He shot them both in the back. They both died. He didn't go to prison. This is outside of his house, running away from his house, unarmed.
Jesus. Yeah.
I distinctly remember that story.
Well, and here's a new one. This one was published over at Gawker. It was filed under what the, right?
Yeah.
Georgia homeowner suspected of killing driver who followed a GPS to wrong address. Now, just try to fill in a few mental blanks here along the way, Jeremy. Check this out. Police in Georgia say a homeowner, let me see who sent this in. Yeah, this was Chris, who's a blue ape in the chat room. Police in Georgia say a homeowner shot and killed a man who accidentally ended up on his driveway after following GPS directions to the wrong house. 22-year-old Rodrigo Diaz was driving with friends to pick up another friend in Lilburn, Georgia, so they could all go ice skating. But Diaz was unwittingly led to the wrong address by his GPS. According to the car's passengers, after waiting a short while in the driveway, they suddenly spotted homeowner Philip Sailors, age 69, coming towards them. The guy came out. He went in again, and he came out with a gun in his hand, and he shot into the air, recalled 15-year-old Yason Jimenez. They reportedly tried to drive away, but Sailors fired his .22 caliber pistol again, striking the car and killing Diaz. Then he called the police and held the car's three passengers at gunpoint until their arrival. He didn't even call an ambulance.
Yeah, that's a fill-in-the-blank story right there.
Yeah. Well, obviously, Mr. Sailors is cranky.
A murderer.
Old and white. And the names tell you, well, Diaz, Jimenez. You know, just not the right color. And here in America, where gun owning protects our freedom, you get to kill them folks, right? If they're going,
I would love to say I'm not. No, I was going to say I'd love to say I'm not terribly shocked. A few years back, I worked for it was FedEx, and I had rented a vehicle. I was a subcontractor at the time for FedEx. Rented a vehicle. Here in Vermont, it's kind of mountainous, rural in certain places. Drove up to a house. It was a box truck. There was a door from the cab into the box. I went into the box. I pulled up the back door, and a double-barrel shotgun was in my face. And the guy asked me who the hell I was. So the gun nuts don't surprise me. It could have been just as easily that I was shot.
Yeah.
And basically, I said, are you out of here?
And if you had...
Like mind, and I and just like that, I said, you ordered something. Why isn't it coming to you? You ordered it.
Yeah. But the thing is, you could have been shot if you'd had a name like Diaz or Jimenez.
Yes, if my skin had probably been a dark color, I probably would have been shot then asked later.
I mean, these were kids in their early 20s going ice skating. And you know what? This guy is mounting a self, a justifiable homicide claim. Sailor's lawyer said his client believed he and his wife were in danger. And see, he believed they were in danger. He didn't know they were in danger. There were no facts to suggest they were in danger. The people were sitting in his driveway when he came out of the house to them. If you believe you're in danger, you pick up the magic telephone box and you dial 9. And one, and one again, and the police come along, and they take away your danger, right? Unless they come. But, you know, if they right. come barreling through your door, absolutely, stand and blaze. But I don't think a 22-year-old kid on his way to ice skating with a screwed-up GPS is going to knock your door down if you don't happen to answer the first time he knocks. Right?
Right. And I see a similarity between this story and the Mark Zimmerman story. I believe in my heart of hearts that Zimmerman, yes, he shot and killed this kid. I believe that he approached Trayvon, and Trayvon probably got the better of him, and in embarrassment, he shot this kid, and in the end, says it's self-defense. I think it's nothing less than that.
Right. Or the guy.
And I see him.
Well, no, remember the story?
Skin releasing all these... No, sorry. I keep running over you because the loop here.
No, I understand. remember the story of the guy who shot the kid for listening to the wrong music too loudly in his car? This is that all over again. And once again, there's a racial component to it.
Yeah, he shot the kid 8 times.
Yeah. You know, this guy's been booked on a charge of malice murder, and he's being held without bond. And here's where it's interesting, and I'm not a proponent of the death penalty. But if there's a conviction in this case, you want to put any bets on whether or not the death penalty gets imposed? Because I'm guessing it doesn't.
I was going to say, I'm not a favor of the death penalty, Bob, but if you get a spare moment at some point tonight, do a search on Vermont Prue murder case. Those two deserve everything they're getting. They basically killed a school teacher in front of her 5-year-old son and then left him in the car after they killed him right next to him. Because she looked pretty and it would be fun. And then... Last week, after a year after this story broke, and basically they did it because he plowed their driveway, her driveway, and something about him, I can see by looking at how he did, gave her the creep, so she fired him. That's why they did it. But last week was released from the state police here that they found child pornography on both their computers.
Oh, God.
Those two deserve everything they're getting. I'm not for the death penalty only. I think they deserve it full throttle. There's no way around it on this one. They do not deserve to see the light of day or to waste taxpayers' money. Few people out there, I think, deserve it, and I think they deserve it.
Well, Jeremy, have yourself a good evening. I'm glad you called in. We really appreciate it, and we will talk soon, all right?
Okay.
All right, you take care. Bye now.
You too. Bye.
From Vermont, that's our buddy Jeremy. About time to wrap up the proceedings for the evening. About 13 minutes before the hour. I mentioned the story coming out of Connecticut, the testimony by Neil Heislin. Just to let this have its own independent reality, I'm going to roll that audio right now. Listen to the words of a father holding a gilt-framed photograph of himself and his little baby son, who never got to be a 7-year-old, because, you know, freedom, Wolverines, right?
Good morning. My name is Neil Heislin. Jesse Lewis was my son. He was 6 years old. He was a victim in Sandy Hook. I'm here today to just hopefully get the word out that changes have to be made. I'll tell you a little bit about Jesse. He was a boy that loved life, lived it to the fullest. Mother and I are both separated. He spent an equal amount of time with both of us. And he was my son. He was my buddy. He was my best friend. I never thought I'd be here speaking like this, asking for changes on my son's behalf. And I never thought I'd be laying at rest. The happiest day in my life was the day he was born. He's my only son, my only family. And the worst day of my life was the day when this happened and I buried him. And I just hope some good can come out of this and changes for mental health, the ban of assault weapons. I just can't fathom why any of us need that in our society or in our home. Why do we need 30-round magazines or cartridges? There's no one in this room here that's got the capability, mentally or physically, to take on 20 people or 15 people where you would need 30 rounds of ammunition. There's no reason for it.
Capably said. Cogently expressed. But the CT Mirror, the Connecticut Mirror, says that when he said that, and it wasn't contained in this audio, the heckler shouted, "Second Amendment!" And that the number of people heckling this man sunk in the agonizing depths of a grief that hopefully few of us will ever fully know. There were a dozen of them. There were a dozen people there ready to torture a man whose son had been torn apart by Adam Lanza's firearm.
they're going to protect our freedom. Right? And they can't even be decent to a grieving father. Stay classy, NRA. Stay classy, gun owners of America. Stay classy. Kevin writing in from Colorado Springs says, Bob, cranky, white, and old about describes it, doesn't it? The unfortunate part is that the stand your ground law is and will continue to be used in the South to get people like you're talking about off of what or to anyone else in this country would think is a blatant case of first-degree murder. What are we coming to in this country? Civil war, perhaps? I hope not, Kevin. I hope not. But those who know history are often doomed to watch other people repeat it. Down in Mississippi, Stan, they've got the nullification, the nullifying fever. They've got a taste for nullification where they've put themselves a committee together. After that Kenyan Muslim with the deep-seated hatred of white people and anti-colonialist tendencies issued his 23 executive orders. 23! 23 orders! That's how he's taken our freedom, and we'll be off to the FEMA re-education camps before we can send John Brown's body. Teabaggers in Mississippi have a committee composed of 14 state-elected officials. And that commission would determine what is and is not within the federal government's power when dealing with the state's constitutional rights. Think of it as 14 ignorant redneck cracker-ass bastards who would supplant their will in place of, say, the United States Supreme Court passing on what's constitutional. The bill, which is listed with the state as an active bill and will be taken up by the Constitution Committee in Jackson, Mississippi, provides measures to, quote, prohibit the infringement of the constitutional or protected rights of the state of Mississippi or its people by means of federal statute, mandate, executive order, judicial decision, or other action deemed by the state to be unconstitutional. It is meant, says one of its proponents, to solidify the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. Nullification. Nullification, the issue that caused Andrew Johnson to say, I'm going to get me a rope, I'm going to ride to South Carolina, I'm going to hang the first man, I'm going to hang the first secessionist I can find as high as Haman, and I'll hang the next one until I keep hanging them until I run out of secessionists. And they backed down. Meanwhile, a few years later, James Buchanan didn't have the guts to stand up to him, and we got a bloodbath into the bargain. Special thing. I don't know if they know they had a civil war or if it's just the kind of thing that turns a man something fierce. Hard to say. Well, I don't know what's going sideways on the sound issues. Maybe we'll get them sorted out by tomorrow. There are many problems on this side. So thank you very much, especially to Janie, who made tonight's fundraising go possible. If you'd like to step in and help support her support, you're welcome to do so. PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. And we are running behind as we run up to the end of January here. It's much appreciated. It's the only way this continues to work. So thanks for all your ideas, your emails this evening, the emails I get off air. Thanks for your participation in the chat room. Thanks for following on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for thanks to our volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Betsy in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Jean and Susan. Thanks to John Fox. Thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and AICACT.org. And always, 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 Gina, Gina, it's all for you.
There are problems that come with such a decision, but today, and I remain a man of peace, I think our military budget is far in excess of anything that is justified, but it is a military-industrial complex, and we have the military we have not just because of our intense global paranoia, but because it is an employment program. You know, for years and years and years, military personnel were never counted among those who were counted by the Labor Department in the employment numbers. That changed under the Reagan administration. That's when we started counting soldiers and airmen and Marines and sailors within the employment numbers because of